not that easy being green. Having to spend each day the color of the leaves.
Is it easy being green? Actor Ed Begley Jr. has been the greenest guy in Hollywood for decades.
Being red.
It was 1970 when Ed bought his first electric car and ate his last hunk of red meat. He lives in a home that runs on solar and wind power. His home is smaller than most other Hollywood star garages. Ed also works very hard to promote the green thing and can currently be seen on his reality show, Living with Ed, which airs on Discovery's Planet Green Channel. Ed has also had roles on more than 200 movies and television shows, including Pineapple Express, which is in the theaters now, Fly Me to the Moon, in the theaters now, the 3D animated feature. Ed Begley Jr., welcome to the Bob Rivers Show. Hello.
Bob, thanks so much for having me on.
Interesting to meet a guy like you. A lot of greenies get criticized, like, for example, Al Gore, for living in big, monstrous houses and flying around the world in private jets. But you, more than most, seem to be able to walk the walk of the talk you talk.
Well, I'm lucky, I suppose, because, I live in a home that's very much the size of the home I was raised in. My dad was an Academy Award-winning actor, Ed Begley Sr. He lived in a house that was about 1,585 square foot as well. So it wasn't a big step down for me to live in a house this size. It's the house size I'm used to, and it's very comfortable. By world standards, this much space is a palace.
You drive an electric car most of the time?
Yeah, I do. I have an electric that's good for around a city like L.A. My transportation hierarchy is walking, number one. I quite deliberately moved to a neighborhood where I could walk to most restaurant shops, and I even walk to work at CBS on a new series I'm doing now. And I walk, number one. Bike is number two. Public transportation, three. Then the electric car is actually a distant fourth, and for trips longer than that, I take my wife's Prius.
Wow. And in the electric car, that's a Toyota RAV4 EV, right? Now, can anybody buy one of those, or are they just rolling a few out to celebs at this point?
Sadly, anybody could buy one, and many people did in 2002, but there was not a lot of demand for them. There wasn't that much demand, and also they didn't make a lot of them. If you only make, 1,000 Camaros, you're not going to have much of a program. You won't make any money making 1,000 of any kind of car. So they only made a few, and anybody could buy them, and very few celebs did. Tom Hanks did, Michelle Pfeiffer. Most of them were just fairly ordinary folks, and a lot of utilities bought them. They bought them years before that to drive around and power them on electricity and go around and read meters and do things like that.
As I understand it, with electric cars, and I've made this comparison before, with electric cars, the batteries are a lot of work and maybe not entirely environmentally friendly to make. We'd have to do the whole, carbon footprint argument on that.
Right.
But where we're at right now is, unless there was a huge demand for a lot of them, an investment in making the batteries smaller and more efficient would take a lot of time. And so I have the question, if electric cars were LCD or plasma TVs and everybody had to have one in their home, would we see a Moore's Law take effect, and would batteries get better and better and better, or is there a limit technologically to how good batteries... I mean, could we someday get a battery that would go 0 to 60 in 10 seconds and take you halfway across the country, or is that unrealistic?
The batteries that we have now in our cell phones and our computers and all those things are mostly lithium-ion batteries. They're lithium polymer batteries, lithium titanate batteries that have a lot of watts per kilogram. And so all those batteries are disposed of to full EPA standards, as is every battery in every electric car, as is every battery in every internal combustion car. You have a lead-acid battery in your internal combustion car, and there's millions and millions of those out in the world to start the normal car, and those must all... They certainly in this country are recycled to full EPA standards. Nobody throws them away because they've got a deposit on them. You'd not only be breaking the law, you'd be breaking the law of common sense. And you have to figure the full life cycle of it, but fortunately, like the nickel metal hydride batteries that are in the Toyota RAV4 and in the Prius are made in a very good way environmentally, and they're also disposed of to full EPA standards and recycled. As much of the material as possible is recycled when those batteries have seen their day. But I'll tell you this much: I know people with 150,000 miles on their RAV4, and they still have the same battery pack.
Bob mentioned LCD and plasma TVs, Ed. I'm wondering if it's okay to have a big TV. That doesn't, that's not
well, it keeps you in and keeps you from going out and starting up the car.
There you go. Whatever keeps you in, I'm fine.
And you're watching Ed Begley on one of his many 200 movies.
I'm trying to tell my wife it'll help heat our home, you know, a big, you know, 50-inch TV or something.
Well, you want to have the most energy-efficient one. And also, yeah, those TVs, anything like a TV, a printer, a computer, like a car battery, that's all e-waste in the case of the computers, printers and everything. Cell phones, that all needs to be disposed of properly. And so that's all something to consider. There's a life cycle, consideration with everything that we make that's electronic. So you have to factor that in when you're talking about, hey, there's toxic elements in solar panels. You have to factor that in. How long will the panel last? Will you get enough power out of that panel over the life of it, you know, to equal the amount of power you put into it to create the panel? You have to consider that.
Now, while you're living your life in Hollywood, you can really dial in on being green because you're in your universe. But if, like David Letterman says, I need you to be on the show tomorrow night, Ed, to talk about your show, which is getting the word out about being green, is it okay for you to take a private jet to New York, since in the long run you're going to do a world of good telling millions of people this stuff?
I wouldn't be comfortable taking a private jet, but I know that point. That's why I cut Al Gore some slack when he has to get around. Him flying commercial would be quite an upheaval for the poor folks on that commercial jet with the Secret Service and everything. But I do not take private jets. But for me, my compromise is to get on any kind of a plane. When I got to be Monday in L.A. and Tuesday in New York to do David Letterman or something, which, you know, that happens once in a while. I mostly drive cross-country in my wife's Prius. But lately, with all these speaking engagements to talk about the environment, I literally factored that in and went, wow, is it a better thing for me to get on the plane and get there? Commercial, of course, not private. And my friend David Suzuki, a noted scientist, said, Ed, you know, I love that you're going door to door in the LA area. You got to get out and talk about these things. So if you need to get in a plane, I do myself once in a while, do it. Take your Prius when you can, but when you got to fly, fly.
Ed, you talked about the regular folks who bought these cars, like Tom Hanks and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes.
And your perspective is amazing, because in the same sentence you said, you know, my home in a world perspective is rather plush, but you live in this opulent little fantasy land of Hollywood.
We must have had a bad connection. I didn't say Tom Hanks and Michelle Pfeiffer were the regular folks. I was saying there were a couple celebrities that bought them, but there was mostly regular folks.
Mostly regular folks actually bought
them.
Okay. My question was, you've been green so long, now it's cool. It's cool to be green, but you've been doing it so long, it wasn't cool. Did you get looks and rolled eyes from folks when you would bike or walk in the early days?
I get those from my wife, Rochelle. She'll roll her eyes, you know, it's on camera on the show Living with Ed. Most people think it's very odd what I do. Well, people used to. Now people are seeing the wisdom of living an environmentally, efficient life. Let's just call it efficiency. If you can give people a cool beverage and a warm shower and just do it more efficiently, what's wrong with that? You know, it'll all clean up the air in cities like L.A., lessen our dependence on Mideast oil, and put money in our pocket if we do it right.
Who killed the electric car? You were in that movie.
Yeah, they're very fair with that. They don't just say GM killed the electric car, because that wouldn't be the truth. There's the Air Resources Board. There's the public who didn't buy enough of the cars, who didn't step up to the plate. There's, lots of different people involved in the demise of the electric car, and they spread that blame around on many shoulders, as they should.
The home you have, let's see, it uses solar and wind power. Tell me about solar, and can any of us do some of this, or do we have to be sort of a celebrity and able to afford? Because this stuff, I looked into solar once a couple years ago. It's kind of expensive.
Yeah, I did not put solar in my house for 20 years of doing this stuff. It took me 2 decades to save up enough money for solar electric. It took me a decade and a half to save up money for solar hot water. I did the cheap and easy stuff first, and that's what my book, Living Like Ed, is about, to do the cheap and easy stuff that's available today. In 1970, I didn't have much of an acting career. I did stuff that was very inexpensive, and it all paid off. I saved money each and every step of the way. So nowadays, people can do the cheap stuff. You can buy an energy-efficient efficient light bulb. You can put weather stripping up. You can get an energy-saving thermostat. Bike riding, if weather and fitness permit. Public transportation, if it's available near you. Home gardening, home composting. All those things I just mentioned, super cheap. You will save money, and if you want, then you do more.
All right, a couple more quick questions. As green as you are, you can't be perfect.
I'm not.
What's a non-green behavior that makes you feel the most guilty? What is it?
We discussed it already, and I'm happy to say it again and beg for forgiveness. But when I have to be Monday in L.A. and Tuesday in New York, then I get in a plane. But I also, to mitigate that CO2, I buy a TerraPass, 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 to offset that CO2. They put new green power out in the marketplace to equal the CO2 from my share of that jet ride. So I fly rarely, but when I do, I buy a TerraPass. Even for my wife's Prius, I buy a TerraPass when I drive up to Seattle, which is my normal way of getting up there.
Now, you have a rivalry with Bill Nye, the science guy, who has vowed to make his home more eco-friendly than yours. Is it a friendly rivalry?
It's become like WWF. It's a smackdown at this point.
Sure.
I'm going to take you down. I'm telling you, I'm going to punish you. It's become kind of absurd, but he is my friend, and we have a lot of fun, and it's a wonderful one-upsmanship, and we're getting a lot of ink for it because he actually has a very green house. He's beating me now, but he only has one person. I've got three people in this house, and nobody in his house has blow dryers or curling irons. I'm not pointing fingers at anybody.
But look at his hair. That's all
exactly.
We're saying.
This may sound silly, but I'm quite serious with this question because I'm sure it's a huge impact with millions of people. Is there a green toilet paper? It's something we all use a lot of and just throw away. Is there one you would recommend that's best for the planet?
There absolutely is, and there's lots of green products that they make. Seventh generation, they make toilet paper and facial tissue and paper towels made out of recycled, post-consumer recycled paper, which is what you want to do. And so it was not toilet paper before, it was other kinds of paper. And if you're going to use any of those paper products, get seventh generation to make wonderful products.
All right, last question, and we want to do you a favor. On Internet Movie Database, it says that your trademark is you speak with a slight lisp. I don't hear any lisp at all. Would you like us to protest that and get that deleted for you on Internet Movie Database?
No, I want your phone for everybody in America then, because I do have a lisp, and that's a great whatever you're filtering on that end is great. I'm going to get that for all my movies and TV shows.
Ed Begley Jr., the greenest man in Hollywood on eco-friendly entertainment. We'll put up a link to all your stuff and your Discovery Channel show as well. Nice talking to you, Ed.
Thank you so much.
My UF is insurance.
Addicted to oil.
Oil.
Addicted to oil. Addicted to oil.
My UF.
Keeping America competitive requires affordable energy.
My UF.
We will invest more in zero emission coal plants.
My UF.
Revolutionary solar and wind technologies.
My new
and clean, safe nuclear energy.
My new
America is addicted to oil.
The price of gas is down this week. Does that mean that Raymond Learcy's book sales are too? Actually, I'm sure that Mr. Learcy's book, which is called Over a Barrel, Breaking Oil's Grip on Our Future, is doing quite well. Raymond is a longtime commodities investor, a former appointee to President Reagan's staff, and a current member of the Woodrow Wilson International Center of Scholars. His book, Breaking Oil's Grip on Our Future, it's available now in paperback. It offers an insider perspective. You ever wondered, Amy, sit around the dinner table and argue over whose fault the oil prices are?
Just about every night.
Sad. But his book will help you know how OPEC destabilizes the world economy by manipulating the oil market. Raymond Learcy, welcome to the Bob River Show. Hello.
Well, nice to be here. Thank you.
So whose fault is it? Who's getting rich?
Well, certainly the oil companies are getting rich. I mean, you've seen the results of Exxon and Shell and what have you. I think Exxon probably earned more money than any other company ever in the first quarter of this year.
What is Exxon, by the way? The face of Exxon is some tanker captain who hadn't worked there in a long time, as far as we know. What is Exxon a foreign company, a United States company, and they're buying a certain amount of oil foreign, and some of it comes from Alaska? And isn't the price set by foreigners, and our people just reap the windfall because they can't sell it cheaper, can they?
Well, can they sell it cheaper or can't they sell it cheaper? You know, a gallon of gasoline in Saudi Arabia costs about 68 cents a gallon, and I think in Venezuela it costs something closer to 20 cents a gallon. And it, you know, can they sell it cheaper? It depends. It depends who's producing, where they're producing, and what the, you know, what government policy is.
Right. It sort of blows my mind that every day we read how much oil is $1.140 a barrel. I think it was close to the peak. Today it's, what, 117. It right. sort of blows my mind that it's one price because, as you just said, some oil is really close to us. Some has to go halfway around the world. Why does it all cost sort of... But in the commodities market, anyway, why is it all sort of the same? And then, as you mentioned, some countries, by the way, subsidize the price of the oil to pay for, you know, keeping their countries alive. How does it actually, and I understand Europe is paying $7, has been for a long time, and we're whining about $4. What's going on there?
Well, in Europe, you know, they have very high taxes for their oil, for their gasoline. And that money is used in large measure to build a very dynamic infrastructure. In Europe, you're not limited to taking your car to go from point A to point B. You can take trains. Trains are enormously efficient. They're timely. They're good transportation. They're comfortable transportation. You don't have to take a car. And in Europe now, all over Europe, they're beginning to put in bullet trains. Trains that travel almost 200 miles an hour.
They're paying for this with gas taxes.
And they're paying a large measure of this with gas tax.
Okay.
And infrastructure.
But the high price of oil hasn't crippled their economies. The dollar is down 20% against the euro.
Well, the dollar is down 20%. It hasn't, you know, the high price of oil hasn't crippled their economy as much as it will have ours, because our infrastructure just doesn't, you know, barely functions. Our government has been very, reluctant to extend money to Amtrak and to really rebuild our passenger rail service, which has sort of been put out of commission years ago under the influence of the oil industry and to some degree the automobile industry. And we really haven't set about to sort of rekindle our you know, the you used to be able to take a train from New York to Chicago. There used to be competitions between the Pennsylvania and the New York Central Railway as to which train got there quicker and which train had better service. All that is gone. All that is past history. We've been absolutely wedded to the automobile, and it's very hard for us to step away from...
Isn't it the airplane that did that, though? Because
no, Joe, it's radio. Well, radio did that. We did that. Entertaining people in their cars.
Right, right. Entertaining people in cars. I mean, driving in a car has always been, to some degree, if you don't run into too much traffic, has been a pleasurable experience.
Because I've told my wife, honey, let's take a train to Chicago. And she's like, you're nuts. Let's get on a plane and we can be there in 2 hours.
Right. Be there in 2 hours, but if we had a bullet train between New York and Chicago or Seattle and Chicago, I mean, you know, you'd have a very pleasant ride, and you'd be there in, maybe 2 or 3 hours more than by plane, but you'd have a very nice experience.
When you count the time you have to get to the airport 2 hours early, when you count the time to wait for the plane, when you count the delays because of the lousy air service, and then you got to land and you got to get a cab and you got to train station to train station usually goes right to the center of a city, you could actually get around a lot of the country in roughly the same amount of time. Plus, you'd be sitting and a waiter would come up and serve you. That's, you know, as opposed to getting your knee broken by this big car. Yeah, trains are wonderful, and we don't. And so you're a big proponent of trains. What else are you a proponent of with regards to breaking oil's grip on our future?
Well, I'm a proponent of something that most people really, you know, don't like the tenor of. I think that we should cap the consumption of fossil fuels in our country. And by that I mean we should have a ceiling, and we should distribute the available fossil fuels through a voucher program whereby everybody who has a car gets an allocation. It's something analogous to the rationing we had during the Second World War.
Wow,
that's weird.
So you're saying when you're out of gas, you are out of gas.
Yeah.
Well, when you're out of gas, you're out of gas. But there's a difference here. These vouchers can be traded. You know, we have an infrastructure now, an electronic infrastructure. Somebody doesn't want to use their vouchers, they can sell them to somebody who needs them.
So the rich will never be out of gas.
That's
poor.
That's a fact of life, yeah.
There. And, you know, you can buy vouchers and then use them to buy gas if that's what you need. But it does mean that we have a cap. No more than a certain amount of gasoline can be sold. But
would that keep the price of oil down, or would it make it go crazy on the black market, or would it change people's behaviors and keep the price down?
It would change people's behavior. It would change the kind of cars we drive. It would absolutely destroy the price of oil. And it would cease the enormous amount, the billions upon billions of dollars that are being transferred outside this country, you know, to countries that really don't wish us well.
I have heard it said that if oil were not like being traded like mortgages used to be on the on the commodities market and futures being sold, that the real value of the price of oil now would still be below $100. Some people even said $50. And if you did that, would that sort of thing happen?
Let me just add one thing about my voucher idea. It would only apply to fossil fuels. Biodiesel, electric, hydrogen, anything else would be open-ended. In other words, you could drive around as long as you like if you tank up with biodiesel.
Raymond, have you talked to any politicians about your voucher idea, and what sort of reaction have you gotten? Because I can't see anyone sticking their neck out in today's society with that kind of a plan.
Well, that's a problem. You know, that's real. There are some politicians, I mean, I've talked to one or two, who seem to conceptually like the idea, even have talked to some of their associates about it. But it's virtually impossible to do that. But we did it during the Second World War, and it gave everybody a sense of participation. And what's happening, I mean, you know, with environmental problems. See, we have three problems. We have an economic problem with oil, we have an environmental problem with oil, and we have a national security problem with oil. And that's all fossil fuels, petroleum-based oil.
And the national security problem is, you say, that we're giving them the money to the wrong guys.
We're giving money to the wrong guys, and not just some money, billions upon billions of dollars. We've transferred $700 billion to suppliers of oil to this country over the last year. Our national deficit is only $500 billion.
This might be a misconception, but I think a lot of people feel this way, and I know I do. Do a few small industries control our gas mileage, our oil consumption? Are the profits of a few small sectors who maybe contribute to politicians' futures, does that control on everything?
Oh, I think the lobbying in Washington has taken the voice of people, you know, has totally overridden the voice of the rest of us. The only way you can pretty well get things done in Washington these days is to have lobbying contacts. Money gives you access. Access gives you power. And the oil industry has enormous resources placed in Washington and has enormous resources invested in lobbying our government.
So is it a better descriptive would be a government by the business, for the business,
Sadly, yes. You know, the rest of us, we just don't really, you know, we elect people and then they go about, you know, worrying about being reelected.
Well, when you elect somebody that's in the oil business, I mean, that was President Bush and Vice President Cheney's business.
Oh, I mean, when you consider that when President Bush became president, the price of oil was $22 a barrel, and it's gone up to $147 a barrel, and now it's around 117. I mean, even at that level, it's extraordinarily high. I mean, nobody in the oil business dreamed that it would go that high.
How much of that is China? I keep hearing that it's China's fault, not the administration's fault.
Well, you know, the oil industry tells us a lot of things that have been sort of repeated in the press ad nauseum and without commentary and without real, you know, without real analysis. Certainly, you know, China consumes, has gone from 5 to 7 billion, excuse me, million barrels a day. You know how much we consume? We consume 21 million barrels a day. And China imports a large portion of that, but they're also developing their own production, you know, out in the Gobi Desert and places like that. And they are also working. They just the other day have instituted a major tax on anybody in China who buys SUVs. And they give a tax rebate to anybody who buys a small car. So they're beginning to do
they would buy small cars. And it's America that's got the thirst for the SUV,
well,
right?
Absolutely.
And we have the big people that we have to put in them. You know what I mean?
Wonder Bread.
No, I mean, SUV is a nice thing to have.
I guess for anybody.
Yeah.
The old Chinese guy to be huge SUV, enjoying himself. All right, so there's many facets to this. And I assume they're all in your book, Over a Barrel, Breaking Oil's Grip on Our Future. Your idea of essentially voluntarily limiting ourselves and accepting vouchers and limits and pain on the people, politically may be impossible, but it sure makes a lot more sense than price controls and things like that, which we've seen don't work.
Right.
So it's fascinating stuff. Raymond Learcy, by the way, it used to work for Reagan. Did somebody transplant Ralph Nader's brain into you at some point? Because you sound a lot like Ralph Nader.
It was a difficult operation.
Yeah, I bet it was. Fascinating stuff, Raymond. We're going to put a link to your book on our website.
Thank you.
Be well, sir.
Bye-bye.
Come and listen to my story about a man named Jed, a poor mountaineer barely gets...
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
What's it feel like to have a billion people watch your foot step on the moon on television?
This man knows. Astronaut Buzz Aldrin was the second man down the ladder and onto the surface of the moon, July 20th, 1969. This moment remains the biggest televised event in the history of the planet Earth. Buzz has also served our nation in the Korean War, the Gemini program, a number of other Apollo missions, and he is the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Currently, Buzz is appearing in Fly Me to the Moon, a 3D IMAX movie that combines animation and the historic Apollo 11 mission to create a very entertaining and educational family film. Every family should see this. Buzz Aldrin, welcome back to the Bob Rivers Show. Hi.
Hello, Bob and company. It's been just a wonderful experience participating in this really high-tech combination of entertainment and history. It's so clever. And I was just so happy to have been able to participate as sort of a walk-on in the epilogue in my flight suit or jacket and explain to people that more than likely the cleanliness of our white room up at the spacecraft probably wouldn't have allowed three flies to stow away. But it's really a very entertaining film, and it mixes human qualities that are given to a colony of flies that are in a dump close to Cape Canaveral.
How real is it, Buzz? I mean, in terms of accuracy, do they use some actual footage? And then when they recreate the experience, how close to how you remember it, and I'm sure it's digitally and visually stunning, but how close to being technically accurate, other than the flies, is it?
Well, I don't think they used actual footage, but they certainly looked at it and then created situations that were not able to be produced in the original footage, as they showed the rocket lifting off and then separating into its different pieces and coming together to proceed on to the moon with the lander attached to the nose of the command module, then the separation that is made and the landing. Of course, it shows the spacecraft making its touchdown on the moon. Then it separates at liftoff, and then they join together. You know, these things are created in a way that that has to be done by animation, because there just wasn't anybody.
Well, we didn't have it at that time.
And it's done so cleverly.
Buzz, I think we put this to rest in a previous interview, but you guys didn't fake that whole moon landing, right? You were really there.
No, we didn't fake it at all, and there were no aliens tracking us or flying along with us.
Right.
Yeah.
And you, but I mean, does everybody, have all the websites been taken down? Does everybody believe you now?
No, no, there's still a few people, and there's scads and thousands of gullible people who give these people the attention that they certainly don't deserve as they look for their moment of glory in revealing something that they know that you don't know, so it becomes a conspiracy on the part of everybody else to withhold information, and that's a bunch of malarkey.
And the other question, and I know you've answered this a gazillion times, but for people who have never heard you before, this has to be asked. Did it ever tick you off to go second? I mean, did you, you know, because Neil Armstrong got the whole one small step for man and blah, 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 and then you got, you know, you got to go second. Did you guys...
Rock,
paper, scissors for it?
There was a very judicious decision made weeks and months before the flight. It was logical to consider if one person was going out alone, as early spacewalking was done, that the commander would stay inside, able to survey the situation and recover from any unforeseen events. But when it was clear that we needed a buddy system of two people outside, then the logical choice was to have the commander, the senior person,
right.
go out first. I certainly did not relish the idea of being such a in-demand speaker and traveling around talking to people all the time. That's not what I relished.
So it was kind of okay with you. And by the way, also, if the
attention that would come,
yeah,
being the first person to
you didn't want that
a worldwide significant event.
And if the and if
I was,
Buzz.
What happens if the moon's surface is made of acid?
And well, I was going to say, and if the rock monster came out and ate Neil Armstrong, you would have got away.
Well, yeah, there are lots of unforeseen things that that could happen, and we tried to anticipate just about everything that that could have gone wrong.
Well, everybody remembers Neil Armstrong's very famous quote, and it was a great soundbite, but you also, I thought, Buzz, asked America to stop for a moment and pause and reflect on what they had just seen and to put things in perspective. And I thought that was a much more important thing to say to America.
Well, yes. At the time, I was, I guess, of the mind that serving myself communion was a good thing to do. And, of course, my ego said that, well, I want to tell the world what I'm doing because it's so important. But I was advised not to do that, and I was very, very correct. And of course, my spiritual concepts have matured and been revised as all of humanity goes through a gradual evolving of our concepts of where we fit into the grand order of things in this wonderful universe of ours.
Speaking of the wonderful universe of ours, one of your fellow moonwalkers has been making a lot of news. That would be Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man to walk on the moon. He says that there are aliens. He believes they do exist and that they have visited Earth several times. What do you think about that as a moonwalker?
Well, I know nothing about any evidence whatsoever that anybody is concealing from anybody else. I think that would be a very irresponsible thing to do by governments, by management, by leadership. Anything as momentous as the Earth being visited by some other creature is something that all of humanity should share in, and I think that it's just responsible to entertain ideas to the contrary. I don't say that one in a billion chance that humanity could be so stupid, but I just don't think that's possible.
As a man who's walked on the moon, Buzz, are you still impressed with 21st century technology like I am? Does the 3D animation and the IMAX and all that blow you away as much?
Well, I think it's the creativity of the human mind that is able to project itself and to have very entertaining, lifelike situations given to creatures like flies that makes it very animated.
Uh-huh.
It just wouldn't be the same if you tried to create that with human beings reacting the way that the flies do. So it is a wonderful mix of historical events created, recreated in an
entertaining
way with family values and other lessons that come out of this film.
Buzz, last question. I'm hearing that our next moonwalk has been delayed again and that Russia may beat us to the moon. Would that fire you up?
Well, we're not in a race anymore. It was a productive thing to challenge our industry to be able to do something as advanced as going to the moon with a human being. I think that was a miraculous challenge that our president gave us that boosted up all of humanity throughout the world, that we did it. Not just one country, but we, humanity, was able to set foot on the moon and walk there and do it so safely. Now, to do that again, we want to be progressive. We don't want to just send one person there for one day and come back. Were China to do that, they would be heroes everlasting. But we're not in a race with China. We're not in a race with Russia.
We want to go there and do something longer lasting. Buzz Aldrin in Los Angeles, the second man to put his foot on the moon. Fly me to the moon. All the best to you, Buzz.
Thank you so much.
And let me play.
A few weeks ago, we set out on what was an impossible mission. We thought it was impossible anyway. We wanted to find a lookalike for a video we were doing for one of our Twisted Tunes. We said, is there anybody out there who looks like Barack Obama? It's difficult. I mean, we do not have a large African-American population here in Seattle. And Barack is a very unique-looking man. I mean, he doesn't look like a lot of people. He looks like Barack. So, boy, were we... And by the way, we also asked for John McCain lookalike. We still don't have a John McCain lookalike. I thought we'd have a busload of John McCains here.
Well,
by 10 a.m.
I would think so, too, but McCain's not considered a good-looking man.
Right.
No knock on him.
So they're out there. They're just going, I'm not calling.
We just need to go to an Elks Club or a VFW or something. They're sitting around everywhere.
We found our Barack lookalike, and he's in the video, Barack's House, which is now posted at bobrivers.com and on YouTube. It's up to like 700 views in one day. I don't know what we have now. I sort of expect it may catch fire at some point. Christopher Armstead is our Obama lookalike, and he's on the phone now. Hi, Christopher.
How you doing?
Great. You are fantastic. You were amazing in the video, and you were, you look so much like Barack Obama. Did you know it before we asked?
It's kind of iffy. A little more than a year ago, I started getting comments. It began with one or two a day, and then it started rolling from there. So pretty much on a daily basis, I get it anywhere from 5 to 10 times a day.
Wow. Do you try to play it up? Do you dress like a president all the time now?
No, that was actually the first time when I had linked up with Keith. That was the first time I ever actually attempted to, play the role, I guess.
Because when you dress the part, it's jaw-dropping. It's head-turning.
I'm glad to hear it. As many times as I've seen the video, I still don't see it to this day. Looking in the
Seriously?
Mirror, I don't see it.
Wow.
What if we stuck your ears out a little further, put some cotton spot
in? He's actually a little better looking than Barack.
Kind
of
are.
When you look at some of his flaws. Barack's, I mean. And now we're about to start another video, Barack Christ Superstar, which, by the way, an advertiser expressed interest in underwriting. and sponsoring.
Really?
Yeah, so we were going to have you ride a donkey, but now it appears you're going to ride a truck from Burien Motors or something like that. No, we'll still go with the donkey. But we're ready to do this video. And two things. Number one, if Barack's name wasn't... Remember, he always talks about his name being his biggest challenge, Barack Hussein Obama. If his name was Christopher, what's your middle name?
Anthony.
Christopher Anthony Armstead.
President C.A. Armstead.
Would that help him or hurt him? I think his name has actually helped him.
I don't know either way. I don't know whether or not it helped him or hurt him.
I mean, you have a more, dare I say, Wonder Bread name. Did you like how I went with Wonder Bread? Than he does.
From my first signing of him on TV, sometime last year, I don't know if it was Oprah or something along those lines, you know, the name didn't strike me any different than any other.
Nice.
Given it is slightly, sort of odd, but at the same time, it didn't make me do a double take or any such thing like that.
Right. So. Do you think you're going to vote for Barack?
I think that question is, it can be answered for in itself. I'd rather not say, but...
You want to keep your vote private? That's fine. I respect that. Oh, my wife won't tell me who she's voting for.
No. Brother for the brother, man. You got to just go and say you're going to vote for Obama, please.
Okay, fine. I'm
going to
vote for
He's going to vote for his brother.
Now, hold on.
It didn't take a lot to drag that out of him.
I know. Chris, are you in the military?
I am.
That's what I let her understand that you are in the military. First off, thanks for your service. John McCain is a decorated war veteran. I can understand how a black American who's in the military would have an inclination to vote for someone who has served and paid such a price for his country.
This is money, Spike. This guy can be a double for Obama in the future, make tons of dollars. If Obama doesn't become the president, he's done. If Obama is the president, this guy can be rich in 5 years.
I don't know if Christopher's. I didn't get that Christopher wants to ride this pony or donkey, if you will.
Well, Chris, let me ask you this, Chris. I don't want to know what you make, but I know that the military is not the highest paying company you can work for. And you do have, whether you see it or not, you have the look of a potential president here. Have you worked on your voice at all for Obama?
Again, no. The only time I've ever even attempted to play this role was there with Keith in Seattle.
In our video.
Eric has some Obama audio queued up. Can you sound
like Obama? Listen in.
I'm Barack Obama, and I'm running for President of the United States. Remember to vote for me in November. And if you don't think I'm funny, you've obviously never seen me bowl.
All right, can you try that?
I could try the first part. I can't remember the whole thing.
That's all right. Just say, I'm Barack Obama, and I'm running for president.
I'm Barack Obama, and I'm running for president.
He's totally kidding.
Yeah. Dude, I'd say right now.
I know that Gilbert Godfrey is living on the Jay Leno money. You could make so much money.
We had a guy that was Ross Perot, and Ross Perot was an also-ran, and this guy made money for 2 years being Ross Perot on The Tonight Show.
You can't lick porcupine and expect not to have your tongue blow up. That just don't make sense.
If Barack gets elected, you've got a few years of gainful employment.
I'm not hedging my bets, but like I said, I took a chance and called the radio station that day, not really thinking anything would come of it. So even just doing that one video was a surprise to me.
Chris, could you start speaking more in broken sentences? I called the station that day, took a chance, didn't know what would come of it.
Because you know what? We all should take a chance. The whole country needs a chance.
This country was built on people taking chances, living the dream.
But to answer the question from earlier, while it isn't about the money, I would say that I make a very fair, decent pay right now. It's taken me a lot of years to get there, but my 15 years in the military has been, I can't say pleasurable, but I would say been very satisfying, and I've learned a lot about myself and the world.
How many more years do you have on your hitch right now?
I could say this may very well be my early retirement year, depending on this Barack Obama thing.
He's going for it.
I got to tell you, Chris, the government may force you to be Barack Obama lookalike, right. And it ain't paying so good. Here, wear this bullseye T-shirt.
Yeah. All right, Christopher, fantastic job. And you know what? Really, even nicer, you turned out to be a wonderful guy, and everybody enjoyed the heck out of working with you and said you were a blast.
And that's right back at you. The group was great. Right. Keith, Shaylin, et cetera, everybody was great. And, you know, I mean, if this second shoot turns out to be the real deal, you know, we're more than willing to come out this Labor Day weekend if possible.
All right. And by the way, it turns out Christopher, who happened to be in Seattle, went back home to what state?
Actually, from Massachusetts first, and then we're back here in upstate New York right now.
He's in upstate New York, so we got to bring him back for this.
Clinton country.
But it's well worth it. Christopher Armstead, our Barack Obama lookalike, and a really nice guy. Christopher, thank you very much.
Thank you. Very much appreciated.
I believe there is a point in growing up for every individual where you form an idea of what rich is. Where something happens or you see something in your life, I remember mine specifically, and you go, wow, they're rich, and it registers. They have a lot that I don't have. Holy cow, it must be money. Gosh, I wish I had it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect that everyone has a moment.
Like, I remember my moment.
You remember your moment?
Very clearly.
Do you remember your I noticed someone is rich moment growing up?
The sad thing is when it's a cousin or an uncle. You know, that's for me it was
you had a rich uncle.
It was
my
me
aunt,
too.
Yeah, my aunt Pam's husband bought them a big house on a hill. And they were members of a country club. And we weren't. Clearly, we're not.
And so they drove you to the country club?
Oh, yeah. We got to stay a week with my aunt at her house on the hill.
Oh, yeah. Looking at the country club?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, well, going to the country club for pool privileges. It was like caddy day in Caddyshack. You know, we were only welcome as guests. We weren't members. Clearly, weren't members.
I went to my Aunt Irma's for Christmas one year. And there it was.
Food.
Pong.
Pong?
Pong.
The game Pong, where you could hit a ball on the TV with a little paddle, and it would go back and forth. And my cousin Art got that for Christmas. I said, you must have all the money in the world to be able to afford something that would do that. Nobody had ever seen
a
that.
Video game.
It was the first video game, and it was like magic.
Was it expensive, or were you just, was that just, were you, it was a bar set low?
It was a lot more than my parents could ever afford. It was, you know, I don't know, it was maybe 100, maybe 200. All I knew is it's something I would never be able to own because I wasn't rich, and they were.
For me, I've only told this once. You may remember it. I met a kid who had a house on the lake.
Lived on the lake or had a lake house?
They lived on the lake.
Okay.
And I didn't know, you know, at a certain age, I don't know what it was, 7, 8, 9, somewhere in there, maybe 10. You don't know that waterfront, like when you say waterfront now, beachfront. Waterfront. What pops into your mind? A huge dollar sign, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Around here.
And so my friends, the Parodies, lived across the street from the lake. You know the Parodies?
Parody? Oh, that's very ironic.
I know. I do song parodies, but they spelled it differently.
But I was thinking P-A-R-I-T-Y.
A parody?
As in, you know,
it's a different kind of parody.
Yeah.
Parody.
But
lady.
They don't spell it like that either.
Yeah.
But they lived in a house that had, I believe, 12 children?
Wow.
8? 16? We had 8. They had more than us. And I was friends with them, and next door was the farm where I would collect eggs. And that was my job every day, was go in the hen house, try not to get pecked by the hen, collect all the eggs and leave them for Uncle the farmer. I've told you that before.
Mm-hmm.
Remember him? He was like 98 years old, smelled like an outhouse. And sweet man. I think he was completely incontinent.
No,
I mean, even the chicken said, get out, please.
Yeah.
You know how chickens are there. So hygienically careful. And so I would collect the eggs. Anyway, one of the Parody kids said, I want to introduce you to Timmy. He's really cool. And he was around the lake on a bluff overlooking the water in this beautiful, you know, timber frame, wood house. And I remember ringing his doorbell, and it was one of those, you know, glorious doorbells.
Double door,
yeah, huge wood, big enough for, like, giants to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to me, little kid, opens this monstrous door. And I look inside, and it's like the most palatial, spacious thing I'd ever seen. You know, we had, like, formica and linoleum and things like that. And they had tile.
Marble.
Not columns, but marble.
Tile.
And I walked inside, and immediately I was stricken with, this guy's rich. And by the way, when you're a kid, you assume the other kid is the head of the household. Did you do that?
Yeah, you said.
This is absolutely all yours. Yep. Fantastic. And by the way, my insecurity, and I don't know if you have this, but my insecurity crept in too. It's like, this kid will never be my friend, not when he sees my house. What do you call that, Eric?
Insecurity.
Thank you.
Envy, yeah.
Well, lack of confidence, something. Something, I assumed that he would have a certain set of values, judgments. I judged him to belittle poor people before I even knew what rich was.
Economic disparity, you could call it that.
Right.
Diminished sense of self-worth.
Lack of parity. Anyway, I walk in, and he's giving me sort of, you know, he's giving me sort of, I don't want to say the cold shoulder, but he doesn't even acknowledge his house. It's just his house to him. I'm like, oh. He's like, yeah, right this way. I'm on my room.
Right this way.
I've got the latest and greatest of everything. Yeah. Anyway, we're sitting in his room, and we're playing some game. We didn't have video games then, by the way. This is pre-Pong, even.
Yeah, Pong was the first.
What he had was an amazing Lincoln Log set up. It was the best.
One that was like multi-barrels.
Oh,
not
yeah.
Just one little barrel.
He could build George Washington's cabin 10 times over.
The whole city.
And we're sitting there playing with his Lincoln Logs, which I remember very clearly.
How old were you?
How old are you? How old am I? Can I be playing with Lincoln Logs? I don't really honestly know.
Well, you're under 10.
I'm guessing 5 or so.
I think I was older than that. Only because I was excited about what happened next. You see, inside little Timmy's house, and I've changed his name, in the middle of the house, do you remember what was in there?
Is this the pool story?
Yeah. A monstrous in-ground pool.
Indoor?
Right? Indoor breathalyzer. In-ground pool. What? Oh, no, dude, go ahead. Yeah, I know you're getting ready with the splash. I pushed the wrong button. This brain will do simple calculations like that all day. So it is a beautiful in-ground pool, and some of you remember what happens next.
Yeah.
Is his mom, probably every bit your age at the time, because we were 5, 6, 7 years old, and back then you had babies at 20.
Mm-hmm.
His mom walks out to the pool, like in a movie, completely nude. Yeah. That wasn't like that. We were too young for that music. It was more like,
oh yeah, that's the music. That's the one.
You know, it's more like pre-stoner.
Oh, Timmy's mom. Mom with your hard buttocks strolling to the poolside.
And I don't know how clearly I'm remembering this, but she was perfect.
Sure, in your mind.
And it was the first real life naked woman I had ever seen.
Other than your mom? Did you ever see your
Never
mom?
Saw my mom naked.
Me
no.
Me
Joe,
neither.
Please.
Knock wood.
Rome would burn to the ground.
I'm telling you, man, with me in it.
You never saw your mom naked either.
No way.
Yeah.
Saw my grandma naked once. That hurt.
Of course I've seen my parents naked.
New age.
Parents?
Yeah.
Liberal West Coast. Come on.
You're a kid and you're all, you know.
I shower with Darby in a bathing suit. Well, swear to God.
Yeah, she's a little too old.
She's the wrong height, first of all. Completely the wrong height.
Anyway, so there she is.
So wait a minute. You're doing Lincoln Logs and Cognitive Wood at the same day. That seems inappropriate.
Hadn't thought of it that way. And she comes out, and she goes out to the diving board. I mean, they've got a full-size pool with a diving board indoors.
Timmy's room looks down on the pool, kind of like an embassy suite situation.
Exactly. The pool's down below. And she walks out because, and she's probably one of the early yoga people, you know, probably did yoga before the masses have heard of it. And she's probably just coming out of her workout. Mm-hmm. And she, and I remember she had her hands folded at the diving board. What's that about?
She's to dive, isn't it?
Or praying, don't let me drown. I don't know.
Is it a part of diving?
Yeah, when you put your hands together and then you dive in.
Okay. And because she did a perfect. Everything about it was perfect.
Sure, you bet it was.
She did a perfect dive. And then she got out and toweled herself off. And Timmy was oblivious to the whole thing.
I would hope.
Did she know Timmy had a little guest over when she was doing this?
Oh, yeah, she did.
Oh, she knew. Yeah.
Yeah, she was
I'm helping Timmy show off how rich we are. You bet she knew.
Yes, she did.
Awesome. We are rich in every possible way.
What did Timmy's dad do, do you remember?
Well, I will tell you why I don't know. I don't know what I did to sour that Timmy relationship at the very first visit. But I never got to Timmy's house again.
You're kidding.
Nope. I banged on that door. I rang the bell.
Winter, summer, spring, and fall.
For about four seasons, yeah. They never answered.
Did you gawk at mom? Did you stare at? I mean,
it's hard to imagine.
Walk all the way.
First off, you know, I'm like eight or nine. Yeah. How do I know?
Yeah.
Did you share that story with any of your brothers and sisters who
Oh no, this was my find. Are you kidding? When you're a kid,
you don't find that arrowhead.
You don't tell the kids which log you hid the Playboy in. That's you right. just don't. That's secret.
Okay, because I was thinking your mom might have called and said Robbie is not coming over there again.
No, you don't go home and tell your parents.
Oh,
mom.
Oh, I knew you didn't tell your mom.
Especially your Catholic parents.
Maybe your brother told your mom or something.
At what point in your life did you meet someone and go, oh my God, that's what rich is?
Good morning, everybody. The morning tea? Dip in the in-ground pool?
Ah, that's the life. You remember where you were when you first became aware that there's something called rich, and you're not it? 1-800-252-1025. For me, it was Timmy's house, in the indoor pool.
Dude, your mom's hot.
Yeah, and the naked mom. But to this day, the indoor pool is still...
It's a pretty good indicator of wealth.
Yeah, I think.
I was amazed that my aunt had... Are you hungry? You want something to eat? I mean, it wasn't mealtime for me growing up. I mean, we weren't poor. Don't get me wrong. We weren't like, you know, stepping on the dirt floors or anything. But you want a sandwich or something? Well, it's not dinner time. Well, if you're hungry, you...
At our house, they ration the food.
Yeah, I mean, tell you, Mom fed you when it was time to feed you. Him had like bowls of candy laying around. You want a sandwich? You want a can of something to drink? Whole can? Yeah, whole can.
A whole can.
It's like being in first class.
So you had no idea if your friend Timmy grew up to be rich or what happened to him.
I never got back into that house again, Joe.
Yeah. My cousin Art, filthy rich. As an adult, the kid who had the Pong game, filthy rich. I think rich, you know, if you can keep your head together.
You can stay rich.
Makes rich, yeah.
I had another friend who was rich, much older. And my friend Bruce, who everybody felt was, you know, trust fund baby. People throw that word around like it's pejorative, don't they? It's not like if a girl is born gorgeous, they don't go trust fund boobies, you know. She didn't earn them.
Yeah.
Just because her DNA gave them to her. But if a guy, you know, or if anybody, you know, comes from money, people sort of, their peers... Use that as a kind of a negative. 1-800-252-1025. Do you remember where you were and how awed you were when you first saw something and it was rich? Vivian, hello.
I was in the second grade, so I couldn't have been more than, 6 or 7 years old. And I went home with a friend from school, And we walked into her house, and she tossed her stuff on the floor, immediately picked up by the maid, who she addressed by her first name, which to me, addressing an adult by their first name was, you know, weird, and said, we will take our milk and cookies on the terrace.
So she ordered a maid around.
I swear.
My cousin and Art's maid, Bessie, I remember her. Same deal.
And the terrace was not the terrace on the house. It was the terrace on the exact replica of the house, which was her playhouse out in the backyard. Yeah.
Now, were you able to become good friends with this girl? Because
she was my best friend all through elementary school until we moved away.
Excellent.
Was a service brat, so I didn't live there too long.
The best way to have stuff is to have someone else pay for it. To this day, you know. I've got friends who are like, I love boats, other people's boats,
yep.
Their gas, their bills, their maintenance. So you did okay.
I'm single. Find me a rich guy.
Would you look for a rich guy on purpose?
Yeah, as long as he had one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel. I want to be Nicole Smith. What's her name, Anna Nicole?
Anna Nicole, yeah, you bet.
Whatever her name is, I want to be that.
You had the assets to attract a rich man? They look for real shallow, good-looking women.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, I am now middle-aged, and I'm not bad for my age, but, you know, rich guys can have the young chicks, so they don't, they're not looking in my direction.
Well, you know, all things are relative, Vivian. What if we found some, like, 85-year-old guy?
Yeah.
Who?
I would do it.
You'd work really hard on him and make him really, really happy?
Sure.
To be in the will.
You'd learn to love the taste of dust.
Yeah.
Is it your face or your body? If you found a sight-impaired guy, I mean, if you're really a firm-bodied person.
I'm not bad for 50.
She's not bad. You just got to look for somebody 80.
Right.
Yeah, it's all things being relative.
Yeah.
All right, phones are open for Vivian's gold digging right here. Ever since she was a little kid and she got taken out onto the terrace.
The terrace.
Mm. I want a maid.
All right. Thank you, Vivian. Hold on. Don't hold your breath, though. 1-800-252-1025. Who remembers when they first saw something rich? Eric Corman.
It was my uncle. It seems to be a relative thing. It's really amazing. Yeah. I was 9 years old. I went to my cousin's bar mitzvah in Cleveland, Ohio, and my family was staying with my uncle's family, my dad's brother. They had a big house in Shaker Heights. It was a Rambler that just seemed to go on and on and on, and they had a pool table. Any house with a pool table, I thought, would definitely made it.
Finished basement with a bar in it.
You and I are... Our sights were set so low. Now, how come you didn't become materialistic at that point, Eric?
Well, it just didn't seem like something achievable at the time. There's nothing I could do about it as a 9-year-old. Felt like I had to sort of accept my lot in life. Because my dad was an engineer, whereas my uncle was a dentist.
But you enjoyed playing on the pool table.
Loved the pool table. Yeah, that was huge. And their yard was tremendously huge, and the corridors in the house went on and on. We were playing football inside the house with my cousins. I mean, that's how big the house was.
Mm. NFL stars, by the way, have houses designed that they can play football in, that they can throw a pass down a huge hallway.
Oh, yeah.
I remember at the Street of Dreams a couple of years ago that I remember hearing that was designed hoping to lure a certain quarterback. I don't want to mention his name. His wife's on The View. And
well, when they put the sign on the big, Hasselback house right on there.
Did they actually put the sign on there?
That's what they told me.
Oh, okay. And I guess he didn't bite. He didn't buy it. 1-800-252-1025. Bob in Renton. Hello.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I grew up out in Gig Harbor. My mom worked. I knew I was poor. But I go to school with these kids, and they invite me over for a birthday party. And I realized that something was up when I drive into the yard and there's alpacas. They're sitting on the edge of a cliff looking out over Fox Island.
Right. Animals that don't even come from this continent, and they have a herd of them.
Exactly. So we go into the house, and it's like this huge house. We go down, and there's this big game room, pool table, foosball, air hockey. There's a bar, popcorn machine.
Oh.
I'm just like, wow, cool.
Interestingly, I'll bet you were primarily impressed with the popcorn machine because that was something you could use, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I'm sitting there, and he introduces his mom, and his mom kept her name, pops off and says, oh, yeah, I'm Jeff's mom. I'm a warehouser, pretty much. His dad owned the Tacoma Stars soccer team, and I was like, you know, his dad's like, hey, we'll take you all to a soccer game. And I'm like, oh, wow, now this is a guy I want to stay in touch with, even if I don't like him.
Mm. Now, how, Jess, I want you to imagine what it's like being rich for a second.
Okay.
Everyone who meets you wants to be your friend.
Exactly.
Yeah, but how many of them really want to be your friend and want to be friends with your stuff?
You wonder if they like you for you or for your money.
Right. You didn't know this guy, but you were like, I got to hang around here. That's the way I was with my friend's naked mom.
Exactly. And this guy, I mean, this guy.
And I kept going back, and I knocked on the door. I rang the doorbell.
Damn! Were you more successful at cultivating a shallow friendship than Bob was?
Actually, you know what? I tried, but the guy was so irritating, I couldn't do it.
Free popcorn and foosball?
Yeah, it just wasn't worth putting up with his arrogant attitude, and you know.
Oh, he knew he had it over you, huh?
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, thank you, Bob.
They're going to make fresh popcorn in about a half an hour. I'll wait for that.
Thank you, Bob. Who else remembers when they discovered what rich was? Daphne in Yelm. Hello,
hi,
Daphne.
Bob.
Hi.
Hello, Robbie Rivers.
Oh, great.
Mine was on an estate in the middle of Paris. And I mean, they had a different room for each meal, and different dishes. I mean, they had so many ancient, hundreds of years heirlooms in the main hall. And we, Daddy worked for the UN, and so Mommy and Bryn and I, my brother, lived downstairs. They kind of didn't want us to be seen, so they had servant cottages out in the, you know, orchards and you know, grape arbors. Oh, my goodness gracious. But the rugs, you know, at that age, the Persian carpets, naturally we sneaked around, my brother and me. And they had a little boy that lived there that, il parle seulement le français. And,
did she just speak what? French? Because with Daphne, it's hard to tell when she switches language. What did she say, Eric?
She said that you were there for 3 years and you studied
and
French.
And I was in Geneva for four.
Wow.
So je parle seulement le français.
How long were we in Amsterdam?
Daphne, we thought you were safely on the peninsula and didn't know how to get across.
No. I spent a whole year in Woodstock.
See, there's a horrible catch here. Mommy was going through a postpartum psychosis, and so we could only live in the servant quarters, and she took me and locked us in to one of them. My father had to take this huge old axe off the wall in the, you know, the hall, which they call, where the warriors used to dine.
So they had, like, knights with axes and stuff hanging around, suits
and
of armor.
He chopped the door down, you know, but
your father
worry.
Chopped the door down to get you out?
Yeah, but, you know,
yeah, but whatever.
At all. But what I remember was the little boy that was part of the house, he knew one American song, and it was, he got the whole wide world
in his hands.
You know what I mean?
He got a really sharp axe in his hands. He got a really
whole
sharp
world in his hands.
Daphne, how did you end up on an estate in Paris with servant quarters?
You know, Daddy worked for the UN, but he was also an engineer, and he worked for Hispano Suiza, which was like we went from country to country trying to find someone to heal Mommy, including India, the yogis, and they actually gave her a tremendous tremendous gifts, but it never quite lasted until America. Well, see, that's what I measured.
Sorry, I asked. Now it's going to go on for a while.
He came up with medication now, which balances right. out the brain chemistry. You know, but there, you know, my father was born in 1896. Both World Wars. He was in RAF Intelligence and W-2. So, like, they had a lot of history behind them before I came along. You know, I mean, I'm not that old or anything, but I'm probably 5 years younger than you, Bobby Rivers, you know. But Another thing I wanted to say is, Casey, I'm on here to read How to Stop Worrying and Start Living by Dale Carnegie.
She wants you to read that book.
No more books.
How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. That's good.
Dale Carnegie, he's the man.
Daphne, always love your call. Thank you.